foremost physician. John Lovell was headmaster of the Boston Latin School. Attorney James Putnam of Worcester had been John Adams's mentor in the law. Foster Hutchinson, jurist and merchant, was the brother of the former royal governor of Massachusetts, Thomas Hutchinson. General Timothy Ruggles, a veteran of the French and Indian War, was a wealthy landowner and outspoken Tory who had been put in command of three companies of loyal American associators, as they were known, who had helped patrol the streets during the siege. John Murray and Harrison Gray were prosperous merchants. A score or more were Harvard graduates, and many were fourth or fifth generation Americans bearing some of the oldest names in the province, such as Coffin and Chandler. Benjamin Faneuil, who was departing with a family of three, was the nephew of wealthy Peter Faneuil, whose many benefactions to Boston had included Faneuil Hall. These were people of wealth and position among the conservative element of Massachusetts, people of distinction by and large, as well as power. But prominent though they were not the majority of those departing with the fleet. Ultimately, 1,100 Loyalists went aboard the ships, and the greater part were from every walk of life: shopkeepers, clerks, minor customs officials, artisans and tradesmen and their families. According to one study, 382 heads of families were farmers, mechanics, and ordinary tradesmen. William McAlpine, printer and bookbinder, declared his first and chief objective was to convey his wife in safety to Scotland. Among the women listed as heads of families was Hannah Flucker, the mother of Henry Knox's wife Lucy, with a household of six. Thomas Flucker, Lucy's father, appears to have departed earlier. Margaret Draper, who joined the exodus with a family of five, had continued to publish the Loyalist newspaper, the Massachusetts Gazette and Boston Newsletter, after her husband's death in 1774. It was the only newspaper available in Boston during the siege. Also listed was Dorcas Griffith, who ran a notorious waterfront grog shop and was known to be John Hancock's discarded mistress. Joshua Loring, Jr. was another of those departing, along with the rebel prisoners he was charged with looking after. But his handsome wife, Elizabeth, is not accounted for, suggesting she may have been provided with more comfortable accommodations aboard the flagship Chatham with General Howe. Many of the crowd were elderly. The Reverend Caner and Dr. Perkins were in their 70s, and many more were children or infants. William Hill, a baker who had supplied bread for the British troops, went aboard with a family of 17. Accommodations on the crowded transports and other ships were wretched. Foster Hutchinson and his large family were assigned to steerage. Wealthy Benjamin Halliwell found himself sharing a cabin with 36 others. Men, women, and children, parents, masters, mistresses, obliged to pig together on the floor, there being no berths, until they left the harbor. Appraising the situation, the royal governor of New Hampshire, John Wentworth, hired a schooner to sail with the fleet and pack 50 people on board. In the next few days, the ships with loyalists began falling down the harbor with the tide as far as King's Road, below Castle Island, to anchor out of range of the rebel cannon, and to provide space for other vessels to tie up at the wharves. And there the exiles sat, rocking with the tide day after day. On March 10th, Howe had issued a proclamation ordering inhabitants to give up all linen and woolen goods that could be of use to the enemy, and assigned a man named Crean Brush, one of a Loyalist corps, to see that the order was carried out. "Sir," Brush's official commission read, "I am informed there are large quantities of goods in the town of Boston, which, if in the possession of the rebels, would enable them to carry on the war. And whereas I have given notice to all loyal inhabitants to remove such goods from hence, and all who do not remove them or deliver them to your care will be considered abettors of the rebels, you are hereby authorized and required to take into your possession all such goods as answer this description, and to give certificates to the owners that you have received them for their use, and will deliver them to the owner's order, unavoidable accidents excepted, and you are to make inquiry if any such goods be secreted in stores, and you are to seize all such. In effect, Brush, remembered later as a conceited New York Tory, was authorized to take whatever he wanted in return for worthless certificates. And once he and his men began plundering the town, gangs with axes, drunken soldiers and sailors, rampaged in the streets, breaking open houses and shops at will. There never was such destruction and outrage committed any day before this, wrote merchant John Rowe. On a visit to Rowe's wharf and warehouse, Brush and his men made off with goods worth more than £2,000. Soldiers and sailors plundering, wrote Deacon Newell on March 13th. Same as above, he recorded the next day. On March 15th, Newell and the other selectmen were summoned to the province house and told the army would embark that day, and that it would be wise for all remaining citizens to stay in their houses. If there were any interference with the king's troops, Howe warned, he would burn the town. But the wind proved unfavorable for departure. Not until Sunday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, did the wind turn fair and favorable. The troops began moving out at 4 in the morning. More than 8,000 redcoats marching through the dark, narrow streets of Boston as if on parade. By 7, the sun was up, and ships thronged at the wharves began lifting sail. By 9 o'clock, all were under way. "Fine weather and fair wind," wrote Major Stephen Kemble, a loyalist serving with the British. "The finest day in the world," wrote an exuberant Archibald Robertson. It was a spectacle such as could only have been imagined until that morning. There were 120 ships departing, with more than 11,000 people packed on board. 8,906 King's troops, 667 women, and 553 children, and in addition, waiting down the harbor, were 1,100 Loyalists. "In the course of the forenoon," wrote James Thatcher, "we enjoyed the unspeakable satisfaction of beholding their whole fleet under sail, wafting from our shores the dreadful scourge of war. People on shore were cheering, weeping. Surely it is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes," wrote Abigail Adams. But then the whole fleet came to anchor at King's Road, and with the arrival of General Howe's flagship, Chatham, every ship of war fired a roaring 21-gun salute, and the full 50 guns of the Chatham answered in kind, an ear-splitting reminder of royal might. The first cheers from the American lines had been heard as early as 9 that morning, when the men on Prospect Hill and Dorchester Heights saw clearly what was happening. In no time, small boys came running across the neck from Boston to deliver the news that the lobster backs were gone at last. Puzzled that British troops appeared still to be manning the fortifications on Bunker Hill, even as the fleet was getting under way, General Sullivan mounted his horse and cantered off for a closer look, only to discover that they were hay dummies set up by the fleeing redcoats. It was early afternoon when the first troops from Roxbury, 500 men who had already had smallpox and were thus immune, crossed the neck and marched into Boston, drums beating, flags flying, and led by Artemus Ward on horseback. By all rights, it should have been Washington who made the triumphal entry, but in a characteristically gracious gesture, he gave the honor to Ward, the thorough New England man who had been his predecessor as commander and the first and most persistent in favoring a move on Dorchester Heights. Though how much this may have figured in Washington's decision is impossible to know. Washington remained at Cambridge, where he attended Sunday services conducted by the chaplain of Knox's artillery regiment, the Reverend Abiel Leonard of Connecticut, who chose for his text Exodus 14:25. "And they took off their chariot wheels, that they drove them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fighteth for them against the Egyptians." Washington rode into Boston the following day, Monday, March 18th, and took a close look at the place for the first time, after 8.5 months of studying it through the lenses of his telescope, almost every day, in every kind of light, and from every possible angle. He came without fanfare. His purpose, as he reported to Congress, was to appraise the damage done and see what the enemy had left behind. The town, although it had suffered greatly, was not in as bad shape as he had expected, he wrote to John Hancock. And I have a particular pleasure in being able to inform you, sir, that your house has received no damage worth mentioning. Other fine houses had been much abused by the British, windows broken, furnishings smashed or stolen, books destroyed. But at Hancock's Beacon Hill mansion all was in order, as General Sullivan also attested, and there was a certain irony in this, since the house had been occupied and maintained by the belligerent General James Grant, who had wanted to lay waste to every town on the New England coast. Though I believe, wrote Sullivan, the brave general had made free with some of the articles in the wine cellar. The last desperate efforts of the British to destroy whatever could be of use to the Americans were in evidence everywhere, spiked cannon, shattered gun carriages and wagons. Ships left behind at the waterfront had been scuttled, their masts cut away. And as Dr. Thatcher noted with concern, smallpox was lurking still in several parts of town. But the surprise for Washington was how much had not been destroyed or carried off. So great had been the chaos and rush of the enemy in the last days. An inventory of British goods compiled by Thomas Mifflin, now the Quartermaster General, listed 5,000 bushels of wheat at Hancock Wharf, 1,000 bushels of beans, and 10 tons of hay at the town granary, 35,000 feet of good planks at one of the lumber yards. There were more than 100 horses left by the British. Indeed, there was nearly everything that was needed but beef, gunpowder, and hard money. Washington estimated the total value at perhaps £40,000, but after further examination, that figure would be raised to £50,000. The other surprise was the strength of the enemy's defenses. The town was amazingly strong, almost impregnable, every avenue fortified, he wrote. But if this gave rise to any second thoughts about his repeated desire to send men against such defenses, or the wisdom of his council of war in restraining him, Washington kept such thoughts to himself. Just as he had shown no signs of despair when prospects looked bleak, he now showed no elation in what he wrote or in his outward manner or comments. On March 20th, Washington put Nathaniel Greene temporarily in command of the town, while he returned to Cambridge to concentrate on his next move. Certain that Howe intended to sail for New York, he had already sent 5 regiments in that direction. But with the British fleet still hovering below Castle Island, he dared not send more, and worried now that Howe's withdrawal might be a trick, that the plan was to come ashore somewhere near Braintree and double back to outflank Dorchester and Roxbury. On the night of March 20th, Boston and the whole South Shore were rocked by a tremendous explosion when British engineers Montresor and Robertson blew up Castle William. The morning after, in heavy snowfall, Howe's fleet dropped still further down from the town to anchor in Nantasket Road off Braintree. Those on board the ships were as puzzled by Howe's intentions as anyone. "We do not know where we are going, but are in great distress," one loyalist wrote. They had been cooped up now in the harbor for nearly 2 weeks. One man, racked with despair, threw himself overboard and was drowned. But to most on board, any destination would be welcome after what they'd been through. You know the proverbial expression, "Neither Hell, Hull, nor Halifax can afford worse shelter than Boston," wrote an officer in description of the prevailing mood. At last, on March 27th, 10 days after the evacuation of Boston, the fleet was again underway, and this time heading for the open sea. When several Loyalists gathered at the rail of one of the ships expressed confidence that they would be returning soon in triumph, A prominent Boston merchant, George Irving, turned and said solemnly, "Gentlemen, not one of you will ever see that place again." Words long remembered by the 5-year-old son who stood beside him. Merchant Irving had sided with the Loyalists primarily because he thought the rebellion would fail. But the success of Washington's army at Boston had changed his mind, as it had for many. By day's end, the fleet had disappeared over the horizon, bound not for New York, but for Halifax. Fast riders carried the news to Providence and Newport, Hartford and New Haven, New York, Philadelphia, then on to Maryland, Virginia, and the Carolinas, and Georgia, 1,100 arduous miles from Boston. For all who believed in the American cause, it was the first thrilling news of the war. The joy of our friends in Boston on seeing the victorious and gallant troops of their country enter the town almost on the heels of their barbarous oppressors was inexplicably great, reported the New Haven Journal. The British, said the New York Constitutional Gazette, were completely disgraced. Free men under arms had triumphed, with all the world watching, and in the admirable and beloved Washington the country had a hero, as the citizens of Philadelphia and members of Congress read in the Evening Post of March 30th. To the wisdom, firmness, intrepidity, and military abilities of our admirable and beloved general, His Excellency George Washington, Esquire, to the assiduity, skill, and bravery of our other worthy generals and officers of the army, and to the hardiness and gallantry of the soldiery, is to be ascribed under God the glory and success of our arms, in driving from one of the strongest holds in America so considerable a part of the British Army. Congress ordered a gold medal struck in Washington's honor. The disinterested and patriotic principles which led you to the field have also led you to glory, read a formal letter of gratitude. Those pages in the annals of America will record your title to be a conspicuous place in the temple of fame, which shall inform posterity that under your directions an undisciplined band of husbandmen in the course of a few months became soldiers. What an occurrence is this to be known in Europe, wrote Elbridge Gerry of the Massachusetts delegation in Congress. How are parliamentary pretensions to be reconciled to facts? What was especially wondrous was that the British had been driven from Boston by only about a 30th part of the power of America. It would be 6 weeks before the news reached London, and on May 6th, a storm of criticism and recrimination erupted in Parliament, led by the same ardent Whigs whose real power was no more than it had ever been. In the House of Commons, Colonel Isaac Barry, Lord Cavendish, and Edmund Burke spoke severely against the administration, as Lord North and Lord Germain defended the management of the war. In the House of Lords, in defense of the ministry, the Earl of Suffolk patiently and correctly explained that abandoning Boston had been the established policy since the previous October. "Let this transaction be dressed in what garb you please," answered the Duke of Manchester. "The fact remains that the army which was sent to reduce the province of Massachusetts Bay has been driven from the capital, and that the standard of the provincial army now waves in triumph over the walls of Boston." At the headquarters in Cambridge, the Boston selectmen and a delegation from the legislature of Massachusetts came to offer their gratitude to Washington for saving the town with so little effusion of human blood, and to shower him with praise. Harvard, in the spirit of the moment, conferred an honorary degree on the man who had had almost no formal schooling. Responding to such tributes, Washington was duly modest and gracious, and in truth they meant more than he showed. "He was happy to hear from different quarters that my reputation stands fair," he wrote privately to his brother. He hoped it would be remembered also that none of what happened had come easily or predictably. "We have maintained our ground against the enemy under a want of powder, and we have disbanded one army and recruited another, within musket shot of 22 regiments, the flower of the British Army, when our strength has been little, if any, superior to theirs, and at last have beat them in a shameful and precipitate manner, out of a place the strongest by nature on this continent, strengthened and fortified in the best manner, and at an enormous expense. He was proud of the part he had played, and wanted to say something about that, at least to his brother, and about the misconceptions he had been obliged to maintain. I believe I may, with great truth, affirm that no man, perhaps since the first institution of armies, ever commanded one under more difficult circumstances than I have done. Many of my difficulties and distresses were of so peculiar a cast that in order to conceal them from the enemy, I was obliged to conceal them from my friends, indeed from my own army, thereby subjecting my conduct to interpretations unfavorable to my character. An attack by Howe on Dorchester Heights had been his utmost wish, and he could scarce forbear lamenting the disappointment he felt. Like others, he attributed the storm of March 5th to the intervening hand of God. He did not lament or repine at any act of providence, he told Joseph Reed, for in great measure he had become a convert to the view of the poet Alexander Pope, that whatever is right. For the loyalists who had fled with the enemy, he had only contempt. Unhappy wretches, deluded mortals, he called them. He had heard of some committing suicide, and thought it would be well if more did the same. By all accounts, a more miserable set of beings does not exist. But then he had little time to dwell on such matters. I am hurried in dispatching one brigade after another for New York, and preparing for my own departure, he informed Reed. The siege had been the stunning success it was proclaimed, and Washington's performance had been truly exceptional. He had indeed bested Howe and his regulars, and despite insufficient arms and ammunition, insufficient shelter, sickness, inexperienced officers, lack of discipline, clothing, and money. His patience with Congress had been exemplary, and while he had been saved repeatedly by his council of war, from his headlong determination to attack, and thus from almost certain catastrophe, he had accepted the judgment of the council with no ill temper or self-serving histrionics. He had kept his head, kept his health and his strength, bearing up under a weight of work and worry that only a few could have carried. Having struggled with his festering dislike of New Englanders, he had proven a keen judge of character and ability and pinned his hopes on such untried, born-and-bred Yankees as Green and Knox. Without Knox, there would have been no triumph at Dorchester Heights. Henry Knox, in sum, had saved the day. And while Nathaniel Green had not played so spectacular a part as Knox, the troops under his command were distinguished as the best disciplined in the army, and he himself had emerged as Washington's ideal lieutenant. In Green and Knox, Washington had found the best men possible, men of ability and energy, who, like Washington, would never lose sight of what the war was about, no matter what was to come. All important, too, was the devotion and loyalty these two young officers felt for Washington. After the miracle of Dorchester Heights, Washington was never again to speak ill of New Englanders because they were New Englanders. He had no illusions about the gravity of what lay ahead, nor did many of the wisest heads in Congress. The humiliation the British had been subjected to, John Hancock warned Washington, could well make them an even more formidable foe. What may be their views, it is indeed impossible to tell with any degree of exactness, Hancock wrote. We have all the reason, however, from the rage of disappointment and revenge, to expect the worst. Nor have I any doubt that as far as their power extends, they will inflict every species of calamity upon us. But great political change was in the offing, Washington sensed, as he confided to Joseph Reed in one of the last letters written from his Cambridge headquarters. This he attributed in good part to the pamphlet Common Sense, published earlier in the year, the author of which, Thomas Paine, was as yet unknown. "My countrymen, I know from their form of government and steady attachment heretofore to royalty, will come reluctantly into the idea of independency," Washington wrote. "But time and persecution brings many wonderful things to pass, and by private letters, which I have lately received from Virginia, I find common sense is working a powerful change there in the minds of many men. The sun never shined on a cause of greater worth," Paine had written. "Everything that is right or reasonable pleads for separation." One after another, the regiments were departing for New York. An army that had moved not at all for nearly a year was on the march, leaving New England for the first time. The huge bastions that encircled Boston were left standing, but only a holding force under General Ward remained to keep watch. To most of the men, the prospect of being on the move was extremely welcome. Spirits were higher than they had ever been. The soldier's life, many decided, had much to be said for it after all. Most of those in the ranks had no idea where they were bound, but were glad to be going. One soldier, John Lapham of Duxbury, wrote to his honored parents to send a pair of shoes as quickly as possible, "For I expect I shall march off soon, but whither we shall go I do not know, nor can I tell." Generals Heath and Sullivan and their forces had already departed. General Greene and 5 regiments followed on April 1st. 3 days later, on Thursday, April 4th, Washington rode off from Cambridge. Part 2. Fateful Summer. The fate of unborn millions will now depend, under God, on the courage and conduct of this army. General George Washington, July 2, 1776. Chapter 4. The Lines Are Drawn. I would not be understood that I should choose to march, but as I am engaged in this glorious cause, I am willing to go where I am called. Lieutenant Joseph Hodgkins. For 2 weeks and more, the army was on the move, its long, irregular columns winding through the untroubled countryside of Lower Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, where open fields and low-lying wooded hills were only now showing the first faint signs of spring. In scores of market towns and crossroad hamlets, the local citizenry came out to cheer and offer food and drink, or just to stand at gateposts and kitchen doorways, taking in the spectacle of so many of their countrymen armed and on the march. Whole regiments passing for hours at a time. Large armies of any kind, were an unfamiliar sight to Americans. No army of such size as this had ever been seen before anywhere in the colonies. And the army was stepping along with great expedition, as General Heath wrote, with high-ranking uniformed officers like Heath on horseback, stragglers and trains of heavy baggage wagons struggling to keep up. Hurry was the order of the day, every day. He must hasten his march to New York, Nathaniel Greene had been instructed by Washington. Henry Knox and his artillery were to move as speedily as possible, and by the directest road thither. Several times Washington referred to his own extreme hurry. On April 5th, the day the commander paraded into Providence, it seemed all Rhode Island had come to catch sight of him. 2 of Greene's regiments served as escort. None were to turn out except those dressed in uniforms, all washed, both face and hands clean, their beards shaved, their hair combed and powdered. At an elegant banquet provided by the gentlemen of the town at Hacker's Hall, Washington was feted and toasted, befitting a national hero. But at first light the next day he was on his way again, with no time to spare. John Greenwood, the fifer, would remember everyone moving at great speed. A 5 or 6 mile march before breakfast was usual, 15 to 20 miles a day, about average, however seasonably wet and unpredictable the weather, or miserable the roads, which, with the frost still coming out of the ground, could be slick with mud even on fair days. On days of wet weather and very bad traveling, recorded a soldier named Solomon Nash marching with the Massachusetts Artillery Company, they made only 10 to 14 miles while moving 10 brass field pieces. Marching did not trouble him anything like he had expected, Lieutenant Joseph Hodgkins wrote to his Sarah after a few days on the road. I am willing to serve my country in the best way and manner that I am capable of, and as our enemy are gone from us, I expect I must follow them. I would not be understood that I should choose to march, but as I am engaged in this glorious cause, I'm willing to go where I'm called. He had vowed to march with cheerfulness, and plainly the spirits of the whole army were greatly improved by being on the move and by the warm reception along the way. I'm a good deal tired of marching, he confessed after crossing into Connecticut, though we get very good entertainment, hospitality, in general. People are very kind to us. Like the majority of Massachusetts men, Hodgkins had never been so far from home. Most of the regiments marched only as far as New London. From there they were to proceed by water down Long Island Sound, keeping close to the Connecticut shore to avoid enemy cruisers. But with movement of any kind, subject always to the elements, and never more than by water, precious days were lost waiting for favorable winds. Or, at great risk, ships embarked in the teeth of foul weather. On April 11th, Nathaniel Greene and his brigade pushed off in a blinding snow squall. 4 days later, with still no word from them, Washington, who was by then in New York, reported to Congress that he feared for their lives. As it was, Greene and his men did not reach New York until April 17th. By whatever means they traveled, all seemed to understand what lay ahead. They were going to meet the enemy on the field of battle for the first time. They were headed for trouble, as Hodgkins wrote. No one knew how many British there might be, yet few let that bother them. An enthusiastic new recruit in the Connecticut ranks, a farm boy named Joseph Plum Martin, would recall, I never spent a thought about numbers. The Americans were invincible, in my opinion. As another soldier remembered, there was scarcely a militiaman who did not think himself equal to 2 or 3 of the British. Appraising the situation from his new headquarters at No. 1 Broadway, a magnificent townhouse just back from the Battery at the southernmost tip of New York, Washington had no illusions about the difficulties to be faced. He was gravely, realistically apprehensive about the magnitude of the enemy force en route. He fretted over when their ships might appear, and how, with no naval strength, to defend a city bounded by navigable rivers on 2 sides and a harbor of a size sufficient to accommodate the largest fleet imaginable. New York was not at all like Boston, geographically, strategically, and in other ways. At Boston, Washington had known exactly where the enemy was, and who they were, and what was needed to contain them. At Boston, the British had been largely at his mercy, and especially once winter set in. Here, with their overwhelming naval might and absolute control of the waters, they could strike at will and from almost any direction. The time and place of battle would be entirely their choice, and this was the worry overriding all others. General Lee, after appraising the situation in February, had been extremely dubious. What to do with the city? I own it puzzles me. It is so encircled with deep navigable water that whoever commands the sea must command the town, he had succinctly summed up the situation. Washington, however, expressed no such misgivings. He would later tell Congress he had not a doubt that he could defend the city, and he was eager to do so for all his anxieties. New York had vast importance, he wrote, because control of its harbor could mean control of the Hudson River, and thus the whole Hudson-Lake Champlain corridor north to Canada, which, if seized by the enemy, could isolate New England from the other colonies, which, in fact, was exactly the British intention. But the decision to make a stand at New York was based more on Washington's political judgment than on military strategy. It was his political sense that Congress and the patriots of New York expected every effort to be made to hold the city, and that anything less would have devastating political effect on the people at large and thus on the American cause, which Washington fervently hoped would soon become the cause of American independence. Possibly he had discussed the subject of New York with members of Congress the previous year, before leaving to take command at Cambridge. And John Adams' letter of January 6th, describing New York as a kind of key to the whole continent, and affirming that no effort to secure it ought to be omitted, was anything but ambiguous. Still, Congress had issued no specific directive to defend the city. The decision was Washington's alone, and he promised unequivocally to exert myself to the utmost to frustrate the designs of the enemy. At Boston, where the comparatively few loyalists of Massachusetts had either fled the country or were bottled up with the British, there had never been a serious threat from internal foes, in Washington's phrase. The spy Benjamin Church had turned out to be an aberration. In New York, the atmosphere was entirely different. The city remained divided and tense. Loyalist or Tory sentiment, while less conspicuous than it had been, was widespread and ranged from the militant to the disaffected to those hesitant about declaring themselves patriots for a variety of reasons, trade and commerce not being the least of them. 2/3 of the property in New York belonged to Tories. The year before, in 1775, more than half the New York Chamber of Commerce were avowed loyalists. When, on a Sunday in January 1776, a prominent pastor, the Reverend John Rogers, preached an impassioned sermon from the pulpit of the Presbyterian Church on Wall Street, exhorting young men to be brave and fight for the cause of their country, he himself was being notably brave in speaking out. "We are involved in the calamities of a civil war," he said, and so it felt in New York. The city and Long Island would provide Washington with 5 regiments by summer, and they would be led by officers bearing prominent names, Livingston, Fish, Roosevelt, Remsen, and Cowanhoven, among others. But the numbers of loyalists still in the city were considerable, and they included men and women from all levels of society. Across the East River on Long Island, in the villages and rich outlying farmlands, where the population was still mostly Dutch, loyalists were a decided majority. Staten Island, at the far end of the harbor, or the upper bay, was another loyalist stronghold. Thus, the potential for conspiracy, sabotage, or organized armed resistance was all too real. At the moment, armed loyalist bands were in hiding in the swamps of Long Island, awaiting the chance to take action. For months, British warships, including the 64-gun Asia, had been a formidable presence, anchored in the upper bay, reminders that the city was entirely at their mercy. It was only on April 8th, just a week before Washington's arrival, that the Asia and its entourage withdrew to the outer approaches to the harbor beyond the Narrows, the water passage between Long Island and Staten Island. On board the King's ship Duchess of Gordon, William Tryon, a seasoned soldier politician who was the royal governor of New York, maintained a headquarters and was believed to be secretly directing loyalist operations. At Boston, Washington had benefited greatly from a steady supply of valuable intelligence coming out of the besieged town, while Howe had known little or nothing of Washington's strengths or intentions. Here, with so much of the population still loyal to the king, the situation was the reverse. Washington's New England army was intact, to be sure, exhausted from its march, as he reported to Congress, but intact and in place. In addition, new battalions had arrived from Connecticut, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, and still more were expected from Maryland and Delaware. All were urgently needed, but they also compounded the threat of regional animosity and discord, which Washington still feared might tear the army and the country apart. "We have nothing, my dear sir, to depend upon, but the protection of a kind providence and unanimity among ourselves," he wrote to John Adams from his Broadway headquarters. Furthermore, as he knew, discipline was hardly improved, and too many of the new troops were raw recruits, as unruly as those of the summer before. Some who were lauded as shining examples of patriotism looked hardly fit for battle, like the Connecticut unit, comprised entirely of aged gentlemen. When they were ordered to New York, reads an old account, this company was the first that reached the place of rendezvous. They were 24 in number, and their united ages reached 1,000. They were all married men and left behind 159 children and grandchildren. Nor did the look and manner of Washington's New England troops necessarily inspire confidence among those from the other colonies. In the stilted phrasing of a young captain from Pennsylvania, Alexander Graydon, the appearance of things was not much calculated to excite sanguine expectations in the mind of the sober observer. To Graydon, who in what he wrote did little to conceal his feelings of superiority, the Yankees were a miserably constituted, unwarlike lot, who did not entirely come up to the ideas we had formed of the heroes of Lexington and Bunker Hill. Most officers were still indistinguishable from their men. Deportment seemed altogether absent. Not until the arrival of the men from Marblehead under Colonel John Glover did Captain Graydon see any New England troops that met his approval. But even in this regiment, he noted, there were a number of Negroes, which to persons unaccustomed to such associations had a disagreeable, degrading effect. One further large and important difference between New York and the experience at Boston was also clear. This time, there would be little call for councils of war to decide whether or not to fight. Washington had arrived in the city with no ceremony on midday, Saturday, April 13th. And went directly to work at the Broadway headquarters. Some days later, after Martha Washington arrived, they would establish a country residence at a beautiful estate overlooking the Hudson River, the Abraham Mortier House, later known as Richmond Hill, 2 miles north beyond the city limits. But No. 1 Broadway remained the commander's base of operations. Known also as the Kennedy Mansion, it was a famous New York landmark. It had been built a generation earlier by a Scottish immigrant and successful New York land speculator named Archibald Kennedy, and had remained the home of a son, Captain Archibald Kennedy of the Royal Navy, until his recent departure for England. The house fronted on Bowling Green and was considered the height of elegance, with a grand stairway, a banquet hall, and a parlor 50 feet long. A garden to the rear reached down to the shore of the Hudson, and from a rooftop platform and cupola, one could see for miles in every direction. As at Cambridge, Washington insisted on having his military family in residence with him, and thus on duty all the time. Unfamiliar with the terrain, Washington set about inspecting the fortifications begun earlier by General Lee, works that had been subsequently carried on under General William Alexander of New Jersey, better known as Lord Stirling, after Congress sent Lee to take command in South Carolina. Lord Stirling was a rich, socially prominent, hard-driving, hard-drinking patriot, who at age 58 looked the part of commander and claimed his title as a Scottish earl through his father. The claim was questionable, but sincere on his part and generally accepted by his fellow officers and the troops he led. Washington thought well of him, and with good reason. Lee and Stirling had had too little time and too few troops to do the job. Men of the town had been pressed into labor, including large numbers of slaves, but this was hardly enough. It will require at least 8,000 men to put this place in any posture of defense, Stirling had stressed. Washington found the defenses only about half done, and even with the troops he had, he knew more were needed. Crowding the streets of the city, the army seemed an overwhelming multitude. The soldiers themselves were emboldened by their numbers. But only half were fit for duty, and Washington worried exceedingly over what the toll from disease would be with the return of warm weather, and from such dissipations as were now readily at hand. Washington had seen enough of New York on prior visits to dislike and distrust the city as the most sinful place in America, a not uncommon view. Larger than Boston, but smaller than Philadelphia, New York had a peacetime population of perhaps 20,000 people crowded into an area of less than a square mile, less than a tenth of the island of Manhattan, or York Island as it was then known, which from the Battery to its northern boundary at the Harlem River reached nearly 11 miles. That far larger stretch, north of the city, known as the Outward, was a mix of woods, streams, marshes, and great rocky patches interspersed with a few small farms and large country estates, all the way to King's Bridge, where a narrow wooden bridge over the Harlem connected the island to the mainland. Normally, it was a city of thriving commerce, shipbuilding, and seagoing trade, and with much to see and talk about. "The inhabitants are in general brisk and lively," wrote one visitor. "The women were handsome," he recorded, as did others new to the city, though he added, "it rather hurts a European eye to see so many Negro slaves upon the streets." Broadway, straight and wide, was the grand thoroughfare, lined with shade trees and fine houses and churches. Queen Street, close to the crowded East River wharves, was the bustling business center. City Hall stood on Wall Street, or in Wall Street, as people said. Henry Knox, stopping at New York for the first time on his way to Ticonderoga in November, had admired the principal streets much wider than ours, and brick houses better built than in Boston. New Yorkers, however, were another matter, as he reported to his adored Lucy. "The people, why, the people are magnificent, in their carriages, which are numerous, in their house furniture, which is fine, in their pride and conceit, which is inimitable, in their profaneness, which is intolerable, in the want of principle, which is prevalent, in their Toryism, which is insufferable." But the city had greatly changed. It had become an armed camp, and thousands of people, perhaps a third of the population, had fled, fearing it was soon to be the scene of terrible calamity. "One would think the city almost evacuated," wrote a dispirited resident. "Business was at a standstill." Large numbers of troops were quartered in vacant buildings and many of the finest mansions. "Oh, the houses of New York, if you could see the insides of them," grieved another resident. King's College, west of the Commons, one of the largest, handsomest buildings in town, had been taken over as an army hospital, once the library books were removed, lest the soldiers burn them for fuel. For the troops from New England, a roof overhead of any kind seemed the height of luxury, and New York, however changed, a center of wonders. Joseph Hodgkins decided, "This city, York, exceeds all places that I ever saw," though he found the living excessive dear. "They have all the simplicity of plowmen," a New Yorker wrote of the Yankee soldiers. And according to one local paper, the New York Packet, they were unexpectedly well-behaved, their civility to the inhabitants very commendable. They attended prayers, evening and morning, regularly, their officers setting the example, the paper noted. On Lord's Day they attend public worship twice, and their deportment in the house of God is such as becomes the place. But an earnest young Presbyterian chaplain with the New Jersey troops, a graduate of the College of New Jersey at Princeton, Philip Vickers Fithian, found the level of piety alarmingly below his expectations, and worried what the consequences might be to the American cause of so many of all ranks so habitually taking the name of the Lord in vain. But alas, swearing abounds. All classes swear, he noted sadly. Lieutenant Isaac Bangs of Massachusetts, who in his journal would provide one of the fullest accounts of unfolding events that spring and summer, wrote of his walking tours about town, and such sights to be seen as the waterworks and the larger-than-life equestrian statue of King George III, which dominated Bowling Green in front of Washington's headquarters. "The design was in imitation of one of the Roman emperors," Bangs wrote. "The king was represented about a third larger than a natural man, and both horse and rider were neatly constructed of lead and gilt with gold, and raised on a pedestal of white marble 15 feet high." With 20 or more churches of differing denominations to choose from, something unknown in Massachusetts, the lieutenant attended as many as possible. An English church, most likely Trinity Church on Broadway, which was Church of England, a Congregational church, a High Dutch church, probably Old Dutch church on Garden Street, where only Dutch was spoken, and the city's one synagogue, Sherith Israel, on Mill Street. He liked the Dutch church best, he decided, preferring the priest's manifest piety to the pomp of the English church, though he understood not a word of the Dutch sermon. On a later Sunday, he and a friend attended a Quaker meeting, but after sitting through 2 hours during which not a word was said, they happily repaired to a nearby tavern. In his conscientious way, Bangs proceeded to investigate the darker side of city life that so worried his commander, embarking into the section called the Holy Ground, a foul slum and brothel district west of the Commons, much of which was owned by Trinity Church, hence the name. By some estimates, as many as 500 prostitutes plied their trade there. Robinson Street especially was notorious for its rough gin shops and bawdy houses. If there was trouble after dark in New York, it was nearly always in the Holy Ground. Bangs, a Harvard graduate with training in medicine, had initiated his own tour of inspection out of concern for the health of his men, though also out of curiosity, as he conceded, and was appalled by what he saw. "When I visited them, the prostitutes, at first I thought nothing could exceed them for impudence and immodesty, but I found the more I was acquainted with them, the more they excelled in their brutality. How any man could desire intimate connection with such creatures was more than he could comprehend. But so it was, and among officers and soldiers alike, till the fatal disorder, syphilis, seized them." On April 22nd, less than a week after the Continental Army moved into the city, all hell erupted in the Holy Ground. The mutilated bodies of 2 soldiers were found concealed in a brothel. One of the victims had been castrated in a barbarous manner, as Bangs recorded. In furious retaliation, gangs of soldiers went on a rampage, tearing to pieces the building where the murders had taken place. Some days later, the remains of an old whore were discovered dumped in a privy, so long dead that she was rotten, as Bangs also recorded. Washington condemned all such riotous behavior. Were it to happen again, the perpetrators would be subjected to the severest punishment. If they resisted arrest, they would be treated as a common enemy, meaning they would be shot dead on the spot. He ordered a curfew and warned that any soldier found disguised with liquor would be punished. Still, it seems, business was business and not to be intruded upon. "Every brutal gratification can be so easily indulged in this place," wrote William Tudor of Boston, Washington's judge advocate, to his fiancée, "that the army will be debauched here in a month more than in 12 at Cambridge. The whores, the trulls, these bitch foxly jades, hags, strums," as wrote another officer, Colonel Loamy Baldwin, "continued their employ, which has become very lucrative." Baldwin, an apple grower from Massachusetts, was one of the officers dispatched to the Holy Ground with military patrols, under orders to deal only with drunken or unruly soldiers. Hell's work, as he said. Since almost no soldiers had uniforms, it was all but impossible to distinguish who among the drunks and brawlers were soldiers and who were not, in dark, shadowed streets lit only by dim oil lamps. Baldwin and his patrol broke up knots of men and women fighting, cursing, crying murder, and hurried them off to the provost dungeon by half dozens. Some were punished, and some got off clear. Hell's work. Meantime, the army was growing sickly. Smallpox appeared, and several soldiers died. Frightful rumors swept through the city, including one that the British had returned to Boston and taken Dorchester Heights. With more bad news from Canada, Washington was directed by Congress to send reinforcements. When approximately 3,000 men under General Sullivan departed by ship up the Hudson, Washington informed Congress he had to have at least 10,000 more. Drill went on in the streets and on the commons. Work on defenses continued under steadily increasing pressure. General Lee, considered an expert on defense, had concluded that without command of the sea, New York could not be held. Still, as he had said, it could be an advantageous battlefield. If the British were determined to take the city, they could be made to pay a heavy toll. Crucial to Lee's plan was the defense of that part of Long Island directly across the East River, and particularly the imposing river bluffs near the tiny hamlet called Brooklyn, which amounted to no more than 7 or 8 houses and an old Dutch church that stood in the middle of the Jamaica Road, the main road inland from the Brooklyn ferry landing. From the New York side of the river, the village was out of sight, 3/4 of a mile back from the partly wooded noble bluff known as Columbia Heights or Brooklyn Heights. All one saw looking across from New York, as Washington frequently did, was the steep face of the bluff rising above the river and crowned now by the beginnings of Fort Sterling, and to the right, also on the brow of the bluff, the country house of Philip Livingston, a wealthy New York importer and delegate to the Continental Congress. When finished, the large square bastion of Fort Sterling, mounting 8 cannon, was expected to command the East River and New York, just as Dorchester Heights commanded Boston and its harbor. From Brooklyn Heights, one looked down on all of New York City, the harbor, the rivers, and the long, low hills of New Jersey beyond. It was one of the grandest panoramas to be seen on the entire Atlantic seaboard. The East River, no river at all but a saltwater estuary nearly a mile wide, was famously difficult to navigate, with swift contrary currents and tides of as much as 6 feet. Because of winds and tides, ferry boats to and from Brooklyn often had great difficulty. Even with 3 men pulling at the oars, crossing the river could take over an hour. The Hudson, or North River, was greater still, more than 2 miles wide, and so, as Lee had acknowledged, impossible to keep closed to the enemy. But with batteries along the New York shore of the Hudson, the British might think twice before risking their valuable ships. Washington agreed with the general outlines of the plan, including, most importantly, the premise that an effective defense of New York City would depend on the defense of Long Island. If New York was the key to the continent, then Long Island was the key to New York, and the key to the defense of Long Island was Brooklyn Heights. For should the enemy take possession of New York, when Long Island is in our hands, Lee had written to Washington, they will find it almost impossible to subsist. That New York or Long Island, or both, could be a trap, neither of them seems to have seriously considered, or at least acknowledged for the record. Given the importance of Long Island, Washington put General Greene in command there, and by the first week of May, Greene and his men, with the addition of a Pennsylvania rifle company, were encamped at Brooklyn. In little time, there were several thousand troops on Long Island, which seemed a great many, but were less than a third of those in and around New York, and their efforts began to show. As would be said, the experience at Boston had made them veterans at least of the spade. In addition to Fort Sterling, 3 more forts were under construction on the other or eastern side of the hamlet of Brooklyn, these intended as a defense of Fort Sterling and Brooklyn Heights. If the British were to come ashore on the broad beaches to the west, in the vicinity of the village of Gravesend, as was widely expected, and attack from the open plains to the south, this line of defense would check their drive for the river. To the left was Fort Putnam, named for Rufus Putnam, who marked out most of the fortifications. In the middle was star-shaped Fort Greene, mounting 6 cannon and commanding the Jamaica Road. On the right was Fort Box, named for one of Greene's officers, Major Daniel Box. Each of these bastions was to be surrounded with a broad ditch, and all were to be connected by a line of entrenchments reaching a mile or more. With hundreds of axemen at work, trees were cut to give full sweep to the fire of the cannon, and along most of the line pointed stakes, pickets, were driven into the ground. Farther still to the right, at an isolated point on the upper bay called Red Hook, a 5th defense, Fort Defiance, was being built. From Fort Putnam on the left to Fort Defiance on the right was nearly 3 miles. As the days grew longer and steadily warmer, the hard labor continued with unrelenting determination. Any soldier caught leaving the works without proper liberty would do constant duty for a week, Greene warned. One Rhode Island officer riding herd on the men, Colonel Ezekiel Cornell, became known as Old Snarl. Green himself was tireless in his efforts. Nothing escaped his notice. He was everywhere on horseback, surveying the work, or scouting the lay of the land, making himself familiar with the whole terrain from Brooklyn to Gravesend, and particularly